firstly from the Gospel of Luke, which is on page 855, if you've got a Bible. You don't need to have a Bible, you can just listen to the reading. Gospel means good news. So this man called Luke, he wrote an account of the life of Jesus. And I'm going to read the first three verses of what he wrote. In it, he explains who he's writing to and why he's writing and what he did to put together his account. So, Gospel of Luke, chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have just been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." And then I'm going to read from Acts and chapter 1 and the first 11 verses. That's on page 909. And the book of Acts is really a sequel to the Gospel of Luke. So Luke has written about the life of Jesus. And then he writes at the beginning of the book of Acts. And he says, "In the first book, O Theophilus, I have dealt with all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day when he was taken up, after he had given command through the Holy Spirit to the apostles whom he had chosen. He presented himself alive to them after his suffering by many proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. And while staying with them, he ordered them not to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father, which he said, 'You heard from me. For John baptized with water, but you will be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now.' So when they had come together, they asked him, 'Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?' He said to them, 'It is not for you to know times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth.' And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white robes and said, 'Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven.'" I'm sure Brian will be saying a little bit more on those readings.
Well, if I can pick up on what I was just saying, some of you have asked, and if not, you have been asked many times. The statement is made, "Well, I don't really have any time for the Bible because we know it's all full of legends. It's all full of made up stories. It's not real history as we know it." And the reason people make those statements is really generally twofold. Number one, they've never really looked at the Bible and studied it seriously for themselves. And secondly, they just pass on what everybody else says, fake information that we're all familiar with today. They simply are told that. They are simply passing on the same information. But they couldn't give you any reason for that. And I think that's a great shame. Because if you begin to look at the Bible, you see very clearly that if the New Testament is a reliable and authentic book, it will give you all the evidence of that. And my purpose this evening is to focus down. Sometimes I speak about the New Testament, an authentic book, the Old Testament, authentic book. Sometimes I package it all together and it's the Bible, an authentic book. But what I thought I'd do this evening, I've actually not done it this way before. I want to focus in one thing in particular, and that's Luke. Now, the interesting thing about Luke is that he wrote the gospel, the gospel that we've just read, Simon's just read part of the gospel, the beginning of the gospel of Luke. He also wrote the Acts of the Apostles. The two are linked together. He refers to Theophilus in both of them. And Luke has a tremendous history basis. We'll look at that in just a moment. But before we come to that, there's a couple of non-Bible people I want to introduce you to. And one of them is Simon Greenleaf. You may never have heard of him. You certainly never met him. He was one of the co-founders of the Harvard Law School in America, one of the most prestigious law schools in the world. And there he produced a couple of volumes that's still used by lawyers in training today in some cases. A couple of volumes on the value of evidence, the laws of evidence in court. And he followed that with an assessment of what he called the testimony of the evangelists. That's the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, examined by the rules of evidence. In other words, you look at the four Gospels and you assume they are going to be on trial in a court of law in our Western world. In his case in America, but it's the same here in the UK. And he gave five basic laws of evidence. He spelt them out, of course, as lawyers always do, in much more wordy language than I've reduced it to. But here they are. And I want you to think about the Gospels when you're looking at these. He says documents have the right to be considered to be true unless they're proven otherwise. Got it? So actually, immediately, the onus is the other way round. People expect us to defend the truth of the gospel records, which is, in a sense, what I'm going to do this evening. But in reality, the truth is the other way. You have to accept that they are true until you prove them untrue. That would happen in a court of law. A document has a right to be accepted true. The prosecution has got to prove that it's a fake. The other thing he said, secondly, the author has a right to be considered trustworthy until he's proven untrustworthy. All of us work like that. You make a statement and you expect people to believe you. If you are known to be an inveterate liar, well, you can't expect people to believe you. But if they know you as a person of integrity and honesty, they will believe you. And sometimes they have to, because if they ask you what you dreamt about last night, only you in the entire world know. They either believe you or they don't. And thirdly, he said, a number of independent witnesses confirms the greater accuracy of the report. Have you realized, of course, that the reason why we have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, is because if we had only one, the critics would say, well, there's only one to go by, you see, and he could have made it all up. So God has given us four. So I'll tell you what the critics do. They spend all their wise time trying to find small discrepancies between one and the other so they can say, well, they're not all saying the same thing. They are all saying the same thing. And there are no discrepancies between them. That's another thing people jump to without actually looking at the evidence. Fourthly, the agreement of their evidence enhances the truth. In other words, if you've got four and they're all agreeing in what they're saying, though they're coming at it from different ways, it's more likely to be true than untrue. That's the law of evidence. That's the law of witnesses. That's what you're looking for in a court of law. Are all the witnesses saying the same thing? They may have all been different ends of the street when they saw it, and they may have all had a different idea of it, but they're all saying the same thing. And then fifthly, their reliability is confirmed if the details match known events. Now, the thing we're going to see this evening is that Luke's details match known events again and again and again through the Gospels and particularly the Acts of the Apostles. And the interesting thing about Luke is that he is expecting you to believe him. Did you notice those phrases? So there they are. I've picked them out in blue here in the reference in Luke. He says, I want to tell you about things that have been fulfilled. So Luke's going to tell you about history, things that have been fulfilled. And I looked for eyewitnesses. I wanted to know people who were there, not second-hand stuff. I wanted to know people who were there. And also, I carefully investigated. I listened to one person, I listened to another, and I put it all together and I carefully investigated. And I want you to know the certainty. You see, he's making it absolutely clear that what he's writing is true truth, true history. And he picks up on this when he introduces to Theophilus, his second edition, his sequel, I think is the word that Si used earlier. In my former book, see, you've read the gospel, haven't you? Now it's time to read the early church. And I want to show you there are many convincing proofs. Now, we're in the gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, just in Luke's writing, he refers to a huge number of place names, all of which we know. 114 towns, provinces, islands, seas, and other identifiable places. 25 political, military, social, and religious events, all of which are known to history. He refers to the famine in Judea in Acts 11 and to the expulsion of the Jews from Rome by the Emperor Claudius in Acts 18, all confirmed by first century texts, and 117 living people by name. Not all of them, but many of them, well-known people of history. In other words, I believe Luke was happy for readers to check him out. He was saying, look, I give you all this information. If I'm not right in the truth, you can easily prove me wrong, can't you? Check me out. And when we do, we find he is always right. I think Luke, who was a physician, a doctor by profession, so the Bible tells us, must have kept a notebook. He couldn't have remembered all these things in his mind. He must have, as he traveled around with the Apostle Paul, he was a companion of Paul, he must have kept a notebook. And you might find yourself saying, hang on, a notebook in the first century? Well, I know they didn't have iPads and they didn't have smartphones, but even a notebook, I said a little bit, you know, that's not really first century, is it? Well, as a matter of fact, it is. Because here is coming up on the screen, a first century notebook. Now, here's a good idea. You take a few slithers of parchment paper, or if you prefer, a few slithers of very thin wood, and you stack them together, punch some holes in the bottom, put a ring through them, and you've made a ring binder. You're looking at a first century ring binder, a notebook. People were using them. We seem to think that people in the first century were all a bit ignorant. Actually, they weren't. People all over the Roman Empire were reading. Every Jewish boy, for example, sorry girls, it wasn't your privilege, but every Jewish boy had good schooling and would learn to read and write. And all over the empire, people were reading all kinds of material. And they all often wanted you to know it. In Pompeii, the island that... Oh, let me just mention one thing here before I roll on. Paul was using a notebook. When he's writing to Timothy, he says, Timothy, will you bring some of my goods with me, my personal belongings, when you come? And don't forget the scrolls and the parchments. Parchments is the word that many of your translations have. Actually, the word he uses, not a Greek word at all, it's a Latin word, membrene. Because the Greeks weren't really they didn't know what to call this new piece of first century technology. So they chose not a Greek word, but a Latin word, the word membrene. And that was a notebook. Paul was using a notebook. There's no question but that Luke would have been using the same. In fact, at Pompeii, the city that was covered in by Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, the baker and his wife, Terentius Nero, there's their picture on the wall. We have it. They had their portraits painted like a family photograph on the wall. And they wanted you to know that they were very educated people. She's carrying a writing script. She's got a little pad in her hand and a script in her, like a pen in her hand. And he's got a scroll. We're no ordinary bakers, you know. We are educated people. They want you to know that. People were reading, writing avidly all over the Roman world. I want to introduce you to the second person, and that is Sir William Ramsay. He's what I call a bucket and spade archaeologist. In other words, he went around Asia Minor, modern day Turkey, digging up bits and so on, and his focus was to see how accurate Luke was as a historian in the Gospel and the Acts. And he was told when he started, you will find him wrong everywhere. Now, Sir William Ramsay was a pretty smart guy. He was no fool, as you will see. He was a professor of Oxford at Aberdeen University. He gained three Oxford and Cambridge fellowships 9 honorary doctorates from British continental and American universities. He gained the Victorian Medal of the Royal Geographic Society in 1906, a founder member of the British Academy, and he was knighted in 1906 for his services to archaeology. He was no fool. And at the end of all his academic work, this was his conclusion. He said, "You may press the words of Luke beyond any other historians, and they will stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment." And he added, "Christianity did not originate in a lie, and we can and ought to demonstrate it as well as believe it." We'll then come to Luke. Luke actually has a huge amount of history in him, as we've seen. And if you go to Luke 2, we won't spend too much time in the Gospel, but if you go to Luke 2, right at the beginning you have an introduction to Caesar Augustus. Now, nobody disputes Caesar Augustus. Everybody knows about him. And Luke tells us at the time of the birth of Jesus that Caesar Augustus ordered a census across, quote, the entire Roman world. Critics leap into that and say two problems. Number one, the Romans didn't have regular censuses. Ramsay has demonstrated and proved in his research and literature that they did, so that argument goes out. And then all over the Roman world. Well, that expression has to be understood, because that doesn't necessarily mean in every part of the Roman Empire, which was pretty extensive. It was really, the word can be used of a locality within the Roman world. In fact, you'll find exactly the same word used further on in the Acts of the Apostles when the Jews are holding Paul up on trial in Jerusalem, and they say he's causing trouble all over the world, not just the Roman world, all over the world. Well, obviously they don't mean all over the world literally, but simply in the world that we know, in Palestine and Judea. That's well understood. So that's not a criticism. We will often say of a particular program, you know, everybody in the world is watching that on Tuesday night. We don't actually expect somebody to say you're lying, because they understand we mean huge number of people have been watching it. And then they criticize it because it says every man had to go back to his hometown to register. Now, just imagine, where were you born? Now imagine every time the government wants a census, you all had to go, you men anyway, had to go back to your birthplace to be registered. Think of the upheaval. Well, number one, people didn't move around then like they do now. Most people were born in a village, lived in a village, died in the village. But so it's not quite the same as today. But apart from that, we actually know that they ordered people to go back to their hometown. You're looking at a parchment scroll of a census taken in Egypt in the year AD 104 AD, in the time of Trajan, the emperor, and it's ordering all the men to return to their home for a census. So you see, immediately, Luke has got it right. He's not made a mistake. We know that from history. Now, this will probably come up in a question, if not, so I'll answer it now. Quirinius, governor of Syria. Problem here is, you see, that we know very well that history agrees that Quirinius was governor in AD 6, and he had a census at that time as well. But Jesus was born around 4 BC. Don't worry about that timing, just take my word for it for a moment. About 4 BC. So Luke got it wrong, because actually the census was AD 6, not 4 BC. Actually, Luke knows that, because if you look at his words carefully, he says this was the first census in his time. That's in Acts chapter 5. So he knows very well that there was a census in the time of Jesus, and then another census later. But more than that, Ramsay showed very clearly, and I won't go into the detail, that actually in BC 6, just before Christ was born, Quirinius was actually a co-leader. He was the military governor, and Sentius Septimius was the civil governor And Septius left earlier, and then Quirinius took over. So that fits perfectly well. There's a little bit of a query on this one. We can't quite always put it together, but there certainly isn't a clear contradiction. It's just one of those question marks we haven't yet fully definitely resolved. In fact, Professor F.F. Bruce said, if Luke's trustworthiness is vindicated in points where he can be checked, we shouldn't assume he is less trustworthy where we cannot test his accuracy. But if we move on from that, when you move on to Luke chapter 3, you've got a whole string of people there. One is Tiberius Caesar. Now, Tiberius was the emperor that took over when Augustus, Caesar Augustus. Caesar Augustus was the emperor at the time of Jesus' birth. Around AD 14, he died, and his stepson Tiberius took over. History knows all about that. That's well known. I popped in here just one little thing because it's interesting that you remember the account, some of you will remember, in Luke chapter 20, the people come up to Jesus and they're trying to catch him out and they say, should we give taxes to Caesar? Now, if he said no, he would be falling foul of the Roman government. And if he says yes, just straight like that, then the Jews would have him because they hated giving taxes to Caesar. So he does a kind of neat sidestep and makes almost them answer the question. And he says, have you got a coin? And somebody came up with a denarius. Now, I've got here a replica of a denarius. You can hardly see it. That is actually the size of it. It's a little bit smaller than a 5p piece. They brought him a denarius, and he said, whose image is it on this? And the answer was, well, it's the emperor's image. Now, the Jews hated that because they hated the idea of an image anywhere. The commandment said, no graven images. So they hated this coin. The other thing on the coin they hated was the fact that it actually called him the divine Augustus. And that made him equal with God. And that was a horrible thing for them to say. So he holds this up and you can see that. And you remember what he says then? He says, all right, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. A little tiny coin like this. And I can imagine Jesus saying, and give to God the things that belong to God. It was a very powerful visual aid. If you want to come and have a look at this, I'll leave it on the table here. No point in taking it with you because it's a replica and it's not worth a penny. Well, it is actually about £3 or £4. Pontius Pilate. Well, you know Pontius Pilate. He's the one who eventually handed Jesus over to be crucified. But there was a time when it was questioned whether Pontius Pilate was a real person because he was only found in the Bible. You can find this sort of thing again and again and again in the Bible. Didn't exist because only found in the Bible. Now, of course, nobody doubts Pontius Pilate. The stone that you've got on the right-hand side of the screen was actually discovered in Caesarea. There were two Caesareas, one in Philippi, inland, and then there's what we'll call Caesarea Maritime. That was on the coast. That was the Roman headquarters in Palestine and Judea. And this was discovered, and it was a piece of recycled work. It was a stone that had been originally part of a temple for Tiberius. It had been recycled in the 3rd century to be part of a stairway in a theatre. So Pirate Tiberius didn't get his glory for too long. But on it, it simply tells us that this is the Tiberium, that the Tiberium would be the temple, which Pontius Pilate, the prefect of Judea, dedicated. So here is Pontius Pilate's name on a stone. And the little coin you've got there, which again is only the size of a 5p piece actually, is a small bronze coin of Pilate's, actually minted in Jerusalem around about the time of Jesus' crucifixion. These things are all things that fit in to the time of Jesus and show that there's a historic basis to it. Now, you only need to run through these people. Tiberius Caesar, we've looked at. Pontius Pilate, we've looked at. Herod the Tetrarch, he's mentioned in Luke 3 as well. Philip the Tetrarch, he's mentioned, all known to history outside of the Bible. And then this rather strange thing, in the time of the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. Now, you can only have one high priest at a time. So why does he mention Annas and Caiaphas? Well, the reason for that is that Annas was actually appointed in AD 6 as the the high priest. But he made a bit of a mess of it in some ways, and he was deposed in AD 15, and Caiaphas took his place. Caiaphas was his son-in-law. But actually, Annas remained. Everybody knew this. He was the power behind the throne. So it's almost Luke's way of saying, well, of course, it was in the time of Caiaphas, but well, everybody knew that Annas was really the power behind the throne at this time. That's well known in history. Luke got the detail actually very correct. Now, I'm going to jump straight into the Acts of the Apostles, because this is just packed with historical references. You have in Acts chapter 12 a Herod Agrippa. Herod Agrippa the First. Now, he was responsible, those of you who know the Acts of the Apostles, for the death of James. He ordered James, the brother of John, to be killed, and he was executed. He also put Peter in prison, and Peter was remarkably and miraculously let out of prison by an angel of God. Now, this Herod was the grandson of Herod the Great, and this was Herod Agrippa the First. Now, the interesting thing about this Herod Agrippa the First is that Luke actually tells us his death in Acts chapter 12, verses 21 to 23, and it went like this. One day he arrayed himself in his wonderful robes, and he went out to give a speech to the people. He was obviously a bit of an orator, and the people applauded him and said, "Oh, this is a god, this is a god." And they worshipped him as a god, and he loved it, because he was a very proud and arrogant man. And Luke says that almost immediately he was taken seriously ill. Luke puts it rather quaintly, eaten by worms, and he died. Well, the interesting thing is that Josephus was a Jewish historian writing around the same time as the apostles. So he's a contemporary historian. And he gives the same account. He adds just a few little details that Luke doesn't put in. He says that when he came out in his fine robe, the sun caught in and it sparkled, and people thought he was a god, and they cried out that he was a god, and he accepted this, and he was so arrogant in this. And then Josephus puts in the fact that he saw an owl sitting up there somewhere, and he took this as a bad omen. And Josephus says he was immediately struck down with a terrible disease and died 5 days later. The only difference in the two stories is the addition to the owl, and the bit that Luke tells us he was eaten by worms, whatever that means, a pretty awful death. But again, that little bit at the end is historically accepted, because you have two historians referring to exactly the same event, and the differences are not contradictory. Now, if those of you who know your New Testament at all often get confused with the Herods. So this is a little bit of a kind of putting them into context for you. There are four Herods that Luke refers to in the Gospel and Acts, and here they are. The first one is Herod the Great, of course. He's the one in the time of Jesus' birth. And then there is Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea, who ordered the death of John the Baptist and sent Pilate. And Pilate sent Jesus to be tried by him as well. That's the other Herod. And then there's the Herod Agrippa that we've just been looking at, a grandson of Herod the Great. He's the one who ordered the death of James, put Peter in prison, and led to this rather gruesome death. And then there is Herod Agrippa. He comes in a bit later in the Acts of the Apostles, you find him in when Paul is on trial in Caesarea. There are your four Herods. You won't remember them, but do remember when you are reading your New Testament, you can read Herod, 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 and it ain't the same person. So don't think it's the same Herod all the way through. Saul of Tarsus was the man who was a rabid Jew, hated everybody who wasn't Jewish, and hated certainly the Christians, and set himself out to destroy the Christian church, threw many men and women into prison. And one day he stood by and watched the first Christian martyr, Stephen, stoned to death, something he never forgot and something he always lamented. That's one reason why he called himself in one of his letters, "I am the chief of sinners." But when he was converted, he very soon went on missionary journeys. And he went on a missionary journey with a guy called Barnabas, And they wound up as part of their first leg of their journey on Cyprus. And on Cyprus, Luke, the writer of Acts, tells us that Paul and Barnabas, when they arrived at Paphos, the central city on the island of Cyprus, some of you may have been there on holiday, he says that Sergius Paulus was the proconsul at Paphos. He's careful to note his position, proconsul. He's careful to actually give us his name. In fact, he goes further and he says he was an intelligent man. Well, of course he was, because actually he accepted the gospel. But this inscription you're looking at here, which was found in 1877, actually confirms, it was found at Paphos on Cyprus, and it confirms that Sergius Paulus was the proconsul in the year AD 47, exactly the year that Paul and Barnabas would have been actually on the island. Moving on from there, the apostles, they're missing out a lot of towns on the way, I'm just jumping, but they came to a place called Lystra. Now at Lystra, a man was discovered there who'd been lame from birth. And Paul performed under the power of God a miracle, and this man got up from his lameness and was able to walk. Immediately, Luke records that the people came along and they started worshipping Barnabas and Paul as Zeus and Hermes, two gods. Now there's a story behind that, and I want to tell you the story. And Luke would have known the story, and Paul would have known the story, but you may not know the story. The story is that Jupiter, the chief Roman god, Jupiter is the Roman name for the god that the Greeks called Zeus. To be really accurate, for any of you who are classical scholars, the two are not exactly the same gods, but for our purpose this evening, we'll assume they are, because they both hold the same role. Jupiter was the chief god for the Romans. And he looked out over Lystra particularly and saw that everybody there was greedy and selfish and horrible, and he was going to wipe them all out. And he took along with him Mercury. He's the god of messenger. He's the messenger god. And Jupiter and Mercury arrived in disguise in Lystra, and they knocked on all the doors as weary travelers and asked for some help. And nobody gave them any help. And eventually they came to the door of a two elderly couple, Philemon and Baucis, his wife. And they welcomed them in. They hadn't got much to offer, but they were about to slaughter their only goose to give these weary travelers a really good feast. And because of their kindness, suddenly the Jupiter and Mercury showed who they were, and they were told the whole town was going to be destroyed, but they would be saved, and they were rewarded. And so the legend went, and it was a legend, the town was destroyed and these two were saved. Ever after that, the people at Lystra were afraid that they might miss the gods if they ever came again. And here comes Paul and Barnabas, and they perform this incredible miracle for a lame man. So it twigs in their mind, they've come back. Except because they were Greeks, they were not calling them Jupiter and Mercury, they were calling them Zeus, he's the chief god, and Hermes. Now Hermes was the messenger god, he's the god who brought messengers to people, he's the god who brought people, the souls of people, into the place of Hades after death, and Hermes is the god who delivers packages to your front door. So here is these gods who, I'm glad some of you use them anyway, here are these two gods they assume came down. So they were worshipping them as these two gods because they didn't want to get caught out yet again. That's the story behind it. Now Luke would have known that. Paul would have known that story. They would have been well aware of the legend behind why they were doing what they were doing. And that's simply a Mercury putting, or Jupiter putting his, not Jupiter, Zeus, Hermes putting his shoes on. Now, we have across England town councils. For all I know, there may be a town council here. It's all a bit boring because no matter what town you go to, they have a council and they're called town councils and councillors. In the first century, across the Roman Empire, and particularly in Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey that we're talking about this evening, they all had different names. In one place they would be called this, in another town they would be called something else. Now here's the accuracy of Luke. He knows exactly what they were called in every place. And this shows that he is a contemporary, because 200 years later these names had changed and you wouldn't know. At Philippi, they were called strategoi, and that's exactly the word he uses in Acts 16. At Ephesus, they were called the Asiarchon, and that's the word he uses in Acts 19. In Malta, he refers to the guy who was in charge as the protos, which is simply the first man. And that might sound a bit bland, but that's exactly what he was, other texts show, inscriptions show, that that's what they called the man in charge in Malta. He was the protos, he was the first man. At Thessalonica, they were called the politarchs. In other words, he knew exactly the right names for the right people in the right place, because he was there, and he wrote it down in his notebook. Make sure if you want to make friends with the people in Thessalonica, don't go and call them Asiarchs, call them Politarchs. In fact, the Thessalonica one is quite interesting because when a Roman arch was being demolished in 1876 in Thessalonica, they discovered this lump of stone. And on it, it had the name, it came from the first century, the second century rather, and it had the name of the politarchs. In fact, the first word in the first line, it's a bit of a mouthful, it's the politarchunton, the politarchs, acting as a politarch. That confirms Luke in exactly having the right name for the right people in the right place. When they came to Athens, Paul is walking around the city and he notices something that was blindingly obvious, and that is this was a very religious city. The story in Athens is very interesting. You can go home and read it in your Bible again and you'll see how important it is. Because he's walking around the city and he sees everywhere he goes there are shrines, there are idols, there are temples, and he wants to get the good news of Jesus to them. So what's he going to do? Well, he noticed that there was one shrine to what was called the unknown god, agnosto theo, an unknown god. And he thought, that's my way in. Let me tell you the story of the unknown god, because you may be thinking that they put that there saying, well, we've got all these idols and maybe we've missed one out. So let's put a shrine to the god we might have missed out. Well, that's actually not how it worked. It was something very different. Some of you may remember that when Paul wrote to Titus, Titus was a young pastor at Crete. And in Titus chapter 1 and verse 12, he says effectively, Titus, you've got a tough job down there. Because, you know, even one of Crete's own prophets and poets has said that the Cretans they're a bad lot. They really are. They're all liars. They are greedy wasters and they are evil brutes. That's what he says. Liars, evil brutes, lazy gluttons. You try and say that of a people group today and you'll soon be finding yourself in court. But that's what Paul says one of the Greek poets says about them. It's not me, says Paul, it's one of their own poets. Now that poet, because Paul was pretty well read, that poet was a man called Epimedes. And Epimedes has a story behind it. Why the unknown god? Well, here's another legend. 600 years before Paul came into Athens, the city of Athens had gone through a terrible plague. And they prayed to all their gods, and none of them worked. And so eventually somebody said, well, you know, there's a kind of poet prophet in Crete. We don't really want to send anyone to Crete, but, I mean, we're Athens. We don't want to send anyone to Crete, but we got no choice. So they sent for Epimenides to Crete, and he came along, and without boring you with the details of the ritual, he did a few rituals, and then he offered a sacrifice of sheep, and the plague stopped. But he never told them who the god was. So they erected an altar to the unknown God. And in fact, other places caught on with the idea, and they erected altars to the unknown God. Paul capitalized on it. Now you go home and read Paul's sermon in Acts chapter 18. It's brilliant. You've got to remember that Paul is actually preaching to the philosophers. And Athens, and Luke actually records, a bit ironically, he says, the men in Athens did nothing but actually talk about the latest idea. That's all they talked about. Got nothing else better to do than that. The ladies were doing all the work, presumably. Well, no, actually, the slaves had been doing all the work. Anyway, here are these Stoic philosophers and these Epicurean philosophers, never mind who they are. And Paul stands up because they say, hey, you've got something different to tell us. What's it all about? And see what he does. You see, these philosophers ensured that if you were going to make a case, every step had to follow logically from the one before, otherwise they didn't want to listen to you. So he starts by creation. He says, look, just open your eyes. You can see we live in a wonderful creation. There is a God. I'm going to tell you about the God you don't know, the unknown God. He's a God who made everything. That's how he starts. Everything. He's in charge of geography. He's in charge of history. It's there, actually. I'm not making it up. It's there in Acts chapter 17. And he is this great God of everything. Now, he says, don't you think it's a little bit foolish to be worshipping this God with little idols and so on? Now, even the philosophers could see there's a logical link there. How stupid. A God who created the heavens and the earth, and you want him down to that size, a little God. That follows. Yes, that's all right. And then Paul kind of lets them off the hook a little bit. He says, look, up until now, you've done it in ignorance. You didn't know. Nobody ever told you. Oh, yeah, that follows as well. We didn't know. You're telling us about the unknown God. Now you do know. Because I'm telling you. And God commands everybody, everywhere, to repent, says Paul. Those are his words. Then he does something very interesting. Because everything's logically followed from here on. And then suddenly he says, and God has proved this by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And at that point they say, you missed the logic. It doesn't follow. And some sneered, says Luke. And some says, yeah, it's interesting stuff, we'll hear you again. And Luke says, and some believed. You go read Acts 17 and you'll see how this fits in with that story beautifully, really. Paul was particularly smart. Now, they move on to Corinth. And in Corinth, the Apostle Paul says, Luke says that Paul met up with Aquila and Priscilla. They were a lovely husband and wife team. They bob up all over the place in the writing of the New Testament because they're moving around quite a bit. Now, they were Jews, and they were in Rome, and in the year AD 43, Claudius threw all the Christians, all the Jews, rather, out of Rome. And the reason he threw them out, says the Roman historian Suetonius, was that the Jews were constantly making trouble and disturbing on the instigation of Crestus. And many believe that that was simply a misspelling of Christ. So because the Jews weren't getting on with the Christians and they were hating the Christians in Rome, Claudius didn't understand this. By the way, Claudius was the emperor who in AD 41 ordered the conquest of what became Britannia Romana. I think we're in Britannia Romana here, they landed on the coast not very far from here, the general who conquered Britain, actually there's good evidence she became a Christian, but that's another story. You can ask me about that later if you want. So Claudius threw all the Jews out, and these Christians are moving around because they've been thrown out, these converted Jews. And no one questions the historicity of that. We know that they were thrown, that Claudius threw them out. And Gallio, it says Luke, was proconsul of Greece, Achaia, at that time. He was appointed by Claudius in July AD 51. And if you doubt the words of Luke, you can actually see it on this. You can't actually read it from where you are, but you can see it on this inscription. The inscription was found in 1905, and it refers to Gallio as proconsul in Greece. And interestingly, on this inscription, it says he was trying to settle quarrels among the citizens. Now, I'm not suggesting that necessarily refers to what actually happened when Paul came in. But when Paul came in to Corinth, it wasn't long before the Jews caused trouble, brought him before Gallio, and wanted Gallio to condemn him. Gallio realized quite quickly that actually this wasn't a civic matter, this was a religious matter, and he wasn't the religious leader. So he said, if it's a religious matter, you sort it out, I'm not interested. And you wonder if that's what's referred to, trying to settle quarrels among the citizens. So he had problems one way or the other. But again, you see, Luke is so detailed and so accurate in all that he says. Now, flipping a slide for Luke just for the moment, but staying in Corinth. If ever any of you have been to Corinth, if you've been to the ruined theatre at Corinth, you will have been shown a marble pavement in front of the ruins of the theatre. And on one of the slabs of the marble pavement is the statement that this inscription, the inscription reads, "The city treasurer Erastus laid this pavement at his own expense." Interestingly, when Paul is writing to the church at Rome, he's actually in Corinth, and he sends greetings to a lot of people in Rome, but also from some people in Corinth. And one of them, he says, is Erastus, whom he calls the director of public works. Now, the Greek word that's used on the inscription and Paul uses is not identical, but it's almost certainly the same office, because it's a financial office in charge of the public works. And besides that, the lexicon of Greek personal names says that Erastus was a very unusual name. Only one in 1,100 men had that name. So almost certainly the man that Paul is sending greetings from Corinth to Rome is the director, the city treasurer in Corinth, who became a Christian. And then he moved on to Ephesus. Now, in Ephesus, Diana, or Artemis as the Greeks knew her, was their great goddess. And they had this magnificent temple. This is just a replica of the temple that they built to show what it must have been like. Beautiful white marble, 100 columns, some of them exquisitely carved. It was a magnificent temple. And people came from all over the empire to worship Diana, or Artemis. She was the goddess of hunting, the goddess of little children, the goddess of childbirth. She was the twin sister of Apollo, daughter of Zeus, and you could go on and on. There were more little statuettes of her around the world even today than probably of any others of the gods or goddesses. This beautiful temple in the middle of the 3rd century AD was completely destroyed by the Goths. But what was happening here was that the silversmiths were making little models of her so that everybody could see and take something home. This is a little model about so big. It's in the British Museum. It actually comes from Ephesus. It's in the 2nd century. So this is the kind of thing that Demetrius was making, and all the other silversmiths. And people would take them home as souvenirs and put them on the mantel shelf at home and worship them. Well, Paul came with the gospel. People were being converted. They were not wanting any more of this rubbish. And this caused a riot. Wherever Paul went, a riot soon followed. You'll find that in the Acts of the Apostles. There was a terrible riot, and he had to eventually leave the city. But here's the interesting thing. That magnificent temple. Do you know what it is today? If you go to Ephesus today, that is all that remains of the temple of Diana Artemis. There are bits in the British Museum and one or two other places around the world, but standing in Ephesus, that's all there is. But where is Paul's gospel today? And the answer is, all over the world. Diana Artemis has gone. On to Jerusalem. Wasn't long when he was in Jerusalem before a riot broke out yet again, and Paul is being mad handled. And it wasn't really Paul's fault, nor was it poor old Trophimus's fault. You see, what had happened was that Trophimus was with Paul, a companion of Paul, and he was a Greek. And they thought, the Jews thought, that Paul had taken Trophimus into the sacred outer court of the temple where only a Jew could go. Now, Paul hadn't done that, nor would he have done, because he didn't deliberately affront the Jewish faith. But they thought he had, and a riot broke out. Now, the reason the riot broke out was because, as I say, it was forbidden to actually a non-Jew, a Gentile, to go into the temple court. And some years ago, they discovered in Jerusalem, they discovered this plaque. Actually, the writing on it had been originally painted in red, and some of the pigmentation was still there. And translated, it read like this: "No foreigner may pass the barrier and enclosure surrounding the temple. Anyone who is caught doing so will be himself to blame for his resulting death." That sign would have been there in Paul's time. He would have seen what you're looking at, only without the English writing on it. It was done in Greek so that all the Gentiles would know and understand it. And I believe that's exactly what Paul had in mind when he wrote to the Ephesians, "Jesus has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility." When you become a Christian, it doesn't matter what your background is, Jew, Gentile, whatever your nationality, whatever your culture, when you become a Christian, you are united together. Jesus has destroyed the barrier. Well, Paul was manhandled by the people, and the Roman tribune in charge at that time tumbled out his Roman troops to rescue Paul. Claudius Lysias is his name, and we know that that was the name of the tribune at that time. He was in command of the cohort. Now, a cohort is one-tenth of a legion. That would be, therefore, about 600 men. What the Romans did was that they always had the main military headquarters was in Caesarea, but they would always have people stationed on the Tower of Antonio, because there they could look down and keep an eye on what the Jews were doing. And this was a festival time, and that was always a dangerous time when riots would break out. And actually, Luke is very accurate, and he talks about the tribune sending out centurions, plural. Now, a centurion was in charge of anything up to 100 men, so he obviously sent out 200 men to rescue Paul. That was pretty big stuff, and the Jews backed off immediately. So they bring Paul in, and he's about to have him beaten. That was the usual thing you did if you wanted to find out what somebody was up to. You gave them a good hiding first. Paul was a Roman citizen, and therefore he managed to get in first. He said, hold on a minute, you do realize it's illegal to beat a Roman citizen without a fair trial. To which the tribune, Lysias, says, a Roman citizen? Are you really a Roman citizen? Yes, he said. How'd you get that? I paid a lot of money to be a Roman citizen. No, I was born in Tarsus, and many of us in Tarsus are Roman citizens. Oh, says Lysias, I thought you were that Egyptian who took 4,000 men out into the desert recently and caused a riot. So where did Luke get that idea from? Well, actually, Luke was very accurate, because we know about that Egyptian. His name was Ben-Stada. And Josephus, the Jewish historian, he tells us that this Egyptian took, well, he says, 30,000 men out to the Mount of Olives. Now, that couldn't be right, because that would be many, many more times than the entire Roman garrison in Palestine and Judea. And that wasn't the case. So Luke's got the figure right at 4,000. That's much more meaningful. Well, actually, the governor at that time, Felix, he turned out the Roman army, and Josephus tells us that he killed 400, took 200 prisoner, but Ben-Stada escaped. So the tribune Lysias assumed that somehow Ben-Stada was causing trouble, and Paul was Ben-Stada. You see, so even there, it all fits perfectly the history that we know of that particular time. And then, if you know the story, comes the assassination plot. By some remarkable coincidence that God organized, Paul's nephew, and that's all we know about the nephew, but he did a remarkably valuable thing. He overheard an assassination plot, and the plot was this: get the tribune to send Paul down for trial at Caesarea. And on the way, 40 assassins who pledged themselves they will not eat anything until they've killed Paul. They'll be in hiding. And when he comes down, they'll have him. Well, the tribune was told about this, and he said to the nephew, "Don't dare tell anybody else that you've told me, because you'll be in big trouble." But he organized for the rescue team, the escort team, to take Paul to Caesarea. Now, this is interesting, because Luke is very specific. He says he ordered 200 of the heavy infantry, 70 cavalry, and 200 lightly armed spearmen. That is exactly the three levels of the Roman army, leaving the sappers aside who built the roads and the artillery who organized the big catapults. But their foot soldiers and their cavalry were the heavy infantry and the cavalry and the lightly armed spearmen. Now that was 470 men. He was expecting trouble. But he obviously knew exactly where the assassination plot was going to take place. Because at a given point, Antipatris, foot soldiers returned. And that was about halfway, because it's a 74-mile, roughly 70, just over 70-mile journey from Jerusalem to Caesarea, roughly halfway, and he knew that the assassins were not beyond there. So Paul went on with the cavalry from there. Now, this was fast marching, because if they went halfway, which would have been a little under 40 miles, and they started at night, and they were there by the next morning, you may be interested to know that a Roman legionary on a forced march could cover over 21 miles in 5 hours with a 70-pound pack. Now, 70 pounds, that's much heavier than the case that you put in the baggage hold of an aeroplane. Now, you carry that for 21 miles in 5 hours on your back. That's all the equipment and the armor that a soldier would have with him. In fact, they could even do faster than that. Julius Caesar once marched his men 90 miles a day for 8 days to Geneva and then fought a battle against the Helvetii and won. These were tough men. I think I'm right in saying that our Marines today have to carry 30 pounds of equipment in 8 hours over 30 miles. They're wimps compared with a Roman soldier. They really are. I'm sorry. I said this once when we had a Marine in our congregation, and I said, "I'm sorry, but that's the truth." And Luke gets it exactly right. He was safely taken down the road to Caesarea. He arrives in Caesarea and he's on trial before Felix, the governor, and both Tacitus, the Roman historian, and Josephus, the Jewish historian. They both refer to Felix, the governor. We know that's correct. And then Festus. We don't know anything about Festus, who succeeded Felix, apart from Josephus, the Jewish historian, and what we read about Luke, but there's no question about that. And then Herod Agrippa, we looked at him a bit earlier. He came in as well. We needn't worry too much about him. Eventually, when Paul had been 2 years in Caesarea and nothing was happening, Paul exercised his Roman citizen's right of appealing to Caesar. And at that point, he was put in charge of Julius, a centurion of the imperial cohort. That is a very accurate picture of a centurion, Roman centurion. I can describe him for you later if you want. Now, Julius would have been a cohort of officer couriers. They were officers who were detailed with a group of soldiers, and they would be taking messages and prisoners from one part of the empire to another, and messages to the emperor and so on. Clearly, he was impressed by Paul, because he gave Paul a lot of leeway in many areas, let him have his own accommodation and so on. But that brings us to a very important part of his life. And we're almost at the end here, you'll probably be glad to know. They were put on board a Roman trading vessel, a merchant ship. And at this point, he begins a story that is quite famous in many ways. It was the journey to Rome and the shipwreck. In 1848, James Smith published a book called The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul. You can buy it today, or you can go online, and if you can find the right place, you can actually download it. And it is 370 pages long, would you believe? I profess I haven't read it all, but I've made myself pretty familiar with a large chunk of it. It is very detailed. James Smith was 60 years a professional sailor. He was educated at Glasgow University, a scholar in Greek and Latin, and many languages. He was a student of geology and archaeology, and an authority on ancient ships and shipping. And he looked at every single aspect. Now, you go home and read in Acts 27, the shipwreck, and you will see a huge number of references to places on the journey, islands, winds, depths of water, things that only an eyewitness there could possibly know. And James Smith went to this in incredible detail and checked it out absolutely thoroughly. Came to the conclusion that this man was an eyewitness and was actually there. In fact, this is one little bit of his 300 odd pages. No sailor would have written in a style so little like that of a sailor. Remember, Luke wasn't a sailor, he was a physician. However, no man not a sailor could have written the narrative of the sea voyage so consistent in all its parts unless from actual observation. This peculiarity of style is to me in itself a demonstration that the narrative of the voyage is an account of real events written by an eyewitness. A similar remark may be made on the geographical details. They must have been taken from an actual observation, because the geographical knowledge of the age wasn't such as to enable a writer to be so minutely accurate in every other way. Now, take my word for it that everyone who knows of this book, and most who concern themselves in the study of the Acts of the Apostle, will be aware of it. All of them, the scholars included, will say this book is a remarkable book, analyzing every aspect of it. And Luke, the man writing, has to be an eyewitness. There's no other way to know the exact depth of the sea at a particular point as they come to the coast. He gives the number of fathoms, to know how the boat was guided and guarded and steered during the storm. The very fact they threw out the stern sea anchors rather than the bow anchors. Well, they did throw out bow anchors at one point and then the stern anchors later. There are good maritime reasons for doing all of that. He goes into all of these details. There is no question but that is an account as somebody who was actually on board. Luke's account and Smith's detailed analysis are of the utmost significance. If this is the character of Luke as a historian, then his gospel and the rest of the Acts of the Apostles must be held with equal respect. Eventually they were washed up on Malta, where he says the chief official, Publius, was the first man, to proto, which we know is exactly what they called the chief man on the island of Malta. Remember what Sir William Ramsay said right at the beginning. You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment. Christianity did not originate in a lie, and we can and ought to demonstrate this as well as believe it. And yet, there's an incredible anticlimax in the Acts of the Apostles. You've had this marvelous story of this man, Paul, who plants churches all over the empire, who writes letters to all these churches, who's beaten any number of times, who's in prison, who's been on trial, who's done amazing things. And he's now in Rome waiting for trial with Emperor Nero, one of the most cruel emperors. And the book ends with what you're seeing on the screen. For 2 whole years, Paul stayed there in his own rented house and welcomed all who came to see him. Boldly and without hindrance, he preached the kingdom of God and taught about the Lord Jesus Christ. Go on, Luke. Finish it off. What's the rest of the story? And the answer? We don't know. Around AD 200, the Christian leader Tertullian wrote that Paul had a similar death to that of John the Baptist, who was beheaded. That is the very most likely result, that either on his first or second trial, because we know he had at least one trial, he was taken out and was executed. We don't know more than that. Why? Some people believe that that's because The account in the Acts of the Apostles was Luke's way of providing a defense for Paul, to show that the Apostle Paul wasn't a troublemaker, but was a man of peace. It was a kind of affidavit to show that this man could be trusted as a good man, and that would go before the court. I'm not so sure about that. Or it may be that he did it because he wanted the Christians to be encouraged to see that Jesus kept his promise that the gates of hell would not prevail against the church. And whatever was thrown at the young Christians, and Paul in particular, the church would go on growing and growing and growing. Whatever it was, one thing we do know, there were plenty of martyrs to follow. What you're looking at now is one of the most moving pictures I think you can see of the ancient world. A group of Christians, an elder standing praying, men, women and children, and the baying crowds around them. We know this happened. Roman historians told us it happened. And they would be mauled to death by the wild animals. And in fact, some around there were actually burned alive. You can see all those people on crosses. Nero, we are told, poured pitch over Christians. Tacitus tells us this, the Roman historian, and set light to them to illuminate his parties. That happened again and again. The question is, why? Why did they suffer? Why were they prepared to die like this? If you go to Jerusalem, as many of you will have been, and if you go to the garden tomb, you can go into a tomb that is very like the one that Jesus was buried in. It's not the one. They shouldn't ever tell you that because it isn't. But you can go in and you can see where the body would be laid. And when you go in and you turn around and you come out, there is a notice on the inside of the door and it says, "He's not here, for he has risen." The resurrection of Jesus Christ demonstrates who he is and what he came to do. And it's that utter conviction that Jesus died and rose again. There was a reason why Christians then and today, all over the world, are prepared to die and are dying for their faith. More martyrs, Christian martyrs, in any one single year at the current time than all the previous centuries. In his gospel, Luke spends one whole chapter reporting on the resurrection of Jesus as a literal event in history, real history. And this, remember, from the man whose accounts have proved accurate wherever they are tested. For 2,000 years, Christians have been prepared to die for their certainty that Jesus is alive. And from every one of us here this evening, the evidence demands a response. Or as the Apostle Paul put it when he was writing to the Corinthians, "Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. He was buried and he rose again on the third day according to the scriptures." So this is the word of God. And it is in fact not only the word of God, but the word of truth, the word of good news of salvation. Thank you for listening. You've been very patient. I've been a bit longer than I intended, but that's because I haven't done this one before, so I rambled on a bit too much. Thank you.